started in just a few minutes. For those who don't know, my name is Lindsay Hanson Park, and I am the newly appointed assistant director, executive director. Newly. Here first. First of all, you should know that Sunstone, like it might seem so fabulous and so well organized and so well funded and like the best conference you've ever been to ever, but there's only actually three staff that are running this show. So I just need to recognize very, very first the staff. There's me, the executive director, and then there's Stephen Carter right here. He is our magazine editor and basically our editor, and he has to work with me, who, as you might know, can't really spell from time to time. So he has a very big cross to bear. So there's Stephen, and then the wonderful Grace Poole, who is running around actually working. Let's give her a big hand. Like, I don't think you can possibly know how hard we all work for this, and we have come together as a team, and they've seen me cry so many times, and you've probably all seen me cry so many times, and it's just, it's run by that. But the symposium is not just done by the three of us. We have an amazing, amazing amount of volunteers that help. First and foremost, I want to talk about our AV team, who you probably don't know this, but these guys have been committed Sunstone AV team way before I got here. They do this on their own dime. They are running around like crazy on their own calories, and they are just amazing. So can we give a big round of applause for our AV volunteers? And I'm going to make him really uncomfortable, but Richard Holdman right here back at the desk. You don't know this about Richard Holdman, but this guy is the one that makes everything happen in All Mormon Studies AV. This guy just does this for every like Mormon organization. He just shows up like a good priesthood elder doing his duty. So thank you for that. I also, yes, yes. And we've had so many amazing volunteers that actually agreed to help and sit with us and do so much work. And I want to give them a round of applause. Some of them are standing back there, and I don't know where some of them are. So let's give them a round of applause. So it's going to be a lot of clapping. And then just a special acknowledgement to some volunteers. So as many of you know, I host a podcast on polygamy, and so I have been able to interact with so many different Mormon groups, which has been one of the biggest blessings of my entire life. And last year, two missionaries showed up at our booth, and they came to register and said, "We're the missionaries." And I was like, "Meh. You are not wearing a white shirt." And I said, "Who's your prophet?" And they looked at me like, "How did you know?" And they ended up being the missionaries from Christ Church. Can Christ Church folks raise your hand? These boys are embodying the essence of what it means to serve. They have been here from beginning to end. And they have been running up and down, and when I need something, it just magically appears. And I'm going to cry, but I'm so grateful for their service and their sacrifice. So thank you to Christ Church. And I'm sorry, I know these announcements get really, really boring. I'm sorry, but this is important too. We also have an amazing board, and we did this on Wednesday night, but if our board members could stand up that are here, I would really like to recognize the ones that are here. So we've got Robin Linkhart, who is an apostle. We have an apostle on our board. That's right. From the Community of Christ. We have Holly Alden, who is an angel on earth. And one of my dearest, dearest friends. And we have Andrew Spriggs. I just call him Spriggs because I'm 15, apparently, who is just like my guiding star. Kim McCall, who is the most gracious person I've ever met and just wonderfully talented. Anyone else that's here tonight? Michael Stevens. I think he left in Bumi. So anyway, so the board members are really, really important to me personally and to the organization. Okay, so one more housekeeping thing, and then I'll sort of talk, sort of get on with the show. I just want, in your name tags, we have left a little blue slip that invites you for next year. The tentative plan is at the Southtown Expo Center. We are outgrowing this venue, and I have good news. It's all going to be on the same floor. So you're all winning. But we're going to ask for patience as we move to a new venue and we are relearning basically how to do everything. There's also something in there that's asking you to donate. Sunstone really has been around for 40 years, but it has survived solely on donations. We can't do it without donations and subscriptions. And so I know you've spent a lot of money here, but like when you feel like you have some extra money to give, please give it to Sunstone because it funds all of these events and this community building that's really important to so many of us. And I just wanted to, last but not least, thank all of you for coming. We talk about building community, and we talk about the value that we feel here. And I don't mean to be cliche, but you guys are all part of this. I talked about this last year, but there was a time in Sunstone's history when people were worried it was going to die. When the LDS Church made an announcement against Symposia in 1991, and the numbers dropped drastically, and created a great wound to this community where people had found so much comfort and joy in celebrating their faith and in the gospel, and it dropped down to almost 200 or 300 overnight. And people that were there talk about it. It was a very difficult and painful time, and they would come together in small groups and commune, and music was one of the ways that they healed and they stayed together as an act of resistance. And it's important for Sunstone's history that we remember that we're here now, and there might be new changes, but there is important history, and we are not here just because of like three staff members and some volunteers. We are here because we have generations of Mormon people like yourselves who refused to be silenced, who refused to stop communing with one another and refuse to give their faith up to a policy. And so we have them to thank. So what I'm really saying is thank you for being here again as an act of resistance to the idea that somebody else gets to tell us our relationship with God, our relationship with our families, and our relationships with someone else. You are here resisting that idea, all of you, and it's an important part, and it can't happen without you. So I want you to give yourselves a hand and the people that have went before us, please. Okay, enough of that. I want to introduce our two performers. This is going to be such a fun night. What we're going to do is we're going to have Elna Baker speak, and then we're going to have Mindy play after. And Elna is going to do a short 15-minute Q&A, so we ask it to be 15 minutes. And so I will cut it off with blood atonement if necessary. Just kidding. I never said that. That didn't happen. We took that out in the 90s. Doesn't happen anymore. So I would like to introduce Elna, who you also have to understand, because we are a poor nonprofit, that the speakers that come here are doing this as a favor. They are doing this as a gift back to their Mormon community, and so I want you to recognize that and hold that gratitude in your heart today. So I want to first introduce Elna Baker. She is a writer and performer of humorous stories. They are very funny. Her stories have been featured on radio programs such as This American Life, The Moth, BBC, Radio 4, and Studio 360. In October 2009, Penguin Books published her book, The New York Regional Mormon Singles Halloween Dance, which chronicles her experience as a young single Mormon living in New York City. And I just have to say that book meant something to me personally, because I was starting to feel very unusual in my ward and a little irreverent, and I felt like something was wrong with me, and I picked up this copy and I thought, oh, I'm not alone. I'm not alone. And Elna Baker was a huge part of that. So without further ado, I bring on the lovely, beautiful, talented, gracious Elna Baker. Hello.
All right. Wow. So I actually did my very first stand-up routine at a young single adults activity in a gym with the linoleum golden floor and those beige dividers. So I feel like I'm going back to my roots today, guys. This is like a dream come true. All right. Let me figure this out. Okay. So I'm so excited to be with you, and I'm so excited that this is happening, you know, that these conferences, I feel like when I was Mormon, I felt alone a lot of the time, and what a wonderful experience that you're all here together sharing how you feel and not being alone. So I wanted to perform three stories for you. The first is an old faithful, one of the first stories I ever wrote. And then I wrote a new story for the conference, which hopefully doesn't suck. And then I'm going to read a piece that I've written. So without further ado, here we go. Starting. Okay. So Mormons are supposed to date other Mormons, which, you know, the whole point is to marry and make more Mormons. And they have to teach us that as kids. And I remember being maybe 13 years old at a youth conference, and the speaker on stage was talking about the importance of dating only members of your faith. And to explain this, he held up a twig, and he said to the audience, "Does anyone think they can break this twig?" And a boy in the front row was like, I can break twigs. So he came up, he took the twig, and he snapped it in half. And then he went to walk off stage, and the speaker was like, whoa, wait. And from behind the podium, he pulled out a whole bundle of twigs. And he held it up and said, "Can you break this bundle of twigs?" And so the boy cockily took the bundle and tried as hard as he could to break it. But he couldn't break it. And the speaker held up the bundle of twigs and said, "So it is with us. If we stick together, all the forces of Satan combined will not be able to break us." And then he set that down. And even at 13, I remember thinking yeah, okay, buddy. But what does this have to do with love? What I believe and think about love? Because when I fall in love, I fall in love. And so it was with this attitude that I moved to New York City when I was 18. And I dated whoever I wanted, mostly non-members. The only problem with that is, as a Mormon girl, I didn't believe in having sex before marriage. So the longest relationship I was able to sustain in New York was 4 weeks. Yeah, and that's only because for 2 of those weeks, the guy was out of town. And then when I was 25, I finally did fall in love. That kind of love that you hope for, where you're just like, who is this person? It's real. I can meet somebody and think I've found, you know, my soulmate. And the guy that I fell in love with was an atheist. So, you know, even though my soulmate didn't actually believe in souls, I was like, cool, I'm in. And he knew I was Mormon, and we decided that we would try to make it work. But then the whole issue of sex came up. And I told him, as a Mormon, I didn't believe in sex before marriage. And he told me that as a guy, he didn't believe in that. So we broke up. And I was devastated. I mean, at 25, I had been waiting to meet this kind of a person that made me that excited, and suddenly I was alone again. And in this very, very sad, dark place, I remember I knelt down and I prayed, and I was like, "Okay, fine, Heavenly Father, I'll do what you said. I'll stick. I'll be a stick. I'll stick with the sticks. I'll date another Mormon, but you need to bring me the Mormon man of my dreams, and you need to do it right now." And you know, like it's not actually that hard to meet other Mormons. They organize the loveliest events for us. And, you know, they're always sort of held in a gym, and they love to, like, set out Kool-Aid and cookies like you're a Little League soccer team. And they have, you know, linger longers after church, or munch and mingles, or chat and chews. Like, it's all about alliteration. If it was like, guys, come eat and talk, I'd be like, I don't know. There's no alliteration. And I was actually just, I was trying to think of my favorite singles activity I went to. And I remember when it was International Women's Day, and they said that they were having a women's appreciation night. And I guess I assumed it was going to be a bunch of feminist speakers talking about, like, women's issues. And I showed up, and they had decorated the gym a fairy princess theme, and each table had different Disney displays. And I walked in, and there were men serving buffet food to the women. And as I walked in, they were like, sisters, we appreciate you. And that was it. There were no speakers. It was just the men cooked and waited on women for one day. And so after I said this prayer, I went to church and I got a flyer for the New York Regional Mormon Singles Halloween Dance, which was a dance where all the Mormons in the tri-state area would descend upon Manhattan. So it would be like three times as many people. And I read the flyer and I was like, it's a sign. You know, because Mormons love to invent signs. It's a sign. I'm going to meet the guy there. And I thought, okay, I just have to have a costume that is literally the best costume ever. And then the guy will meet me, see me, fall in love. This is it. So I started to brainstorm. And I was like, okay, what can I be? What can I be? And it hit me in a flash of light. I was like, oh, I'll be a fortune cookie. And I'll make the fortune retractable. And when you pull it out, it'll say, you will meet a beautiful woman tonight. At which point I could be like, look no further. So I spent, like, I think an entire week building this costume. It was, I took a old, like, a mattress, beige mattress pad. I put wire around it. I, like, shaped it like a fortune cookie. And then I made the fortune, you would pull out a fortune. I wrote 50 of them so that a guy could pull it out and keep it as a souvenir. And I looked in the mirror, and to be fair, it was, like, the greatest. My mind created this thing. It was breathtakingly good. And I looked in the mirror and I was like, okay, here I come. And then I got on the subway to go to the church dance. I had to take one train halfway up and then switch to the 1-9 train. I was only going to be on it for maybe one or two stops. And on the way there, people were like smiling and laughing. And I was like, you know. And then I got on this train. And the second I stepped on the train, it was like this loud noise from the other end of the train was like, oh, no, 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 no. And I, you know, when you're in a small compartment and there's a commotion, everyone starts looking around, and I'm looking around like, what's happening? Is something going on? And then all of a sudden I see that she's looking directly at me, and she points at me, and she's like, I got my children with me. I got my children with me. And I was like, what is it? I was like, does she have a bad experience with Chinese food? So I stepped out of the train, and I walked up the steps to the dance, and I pushed the elevator button, and I was just about to go up when I happened to glance in a full-length mirror, and I was like, oh, no. No, 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 no. Something happened to my costume as I was walking. The fortune cookie center had, like, folded in on itself, creating these, like, flesh-toned flaps. So I did not look like a fortune cookie. I looked like a giant vagina. And you can't, you know, go to a Mormon dance dressed as a giant vagina. And I had this moment in the mirror of just, like, sheer horror, just like, I'm a vagina. Do I stay? Do I go? The one, he's upstairs. I have to. So I decided to. I took off my vagina and I hid it in a broom closet, which is basically what you do every time you go to church. And I was wearing nude leggings and a nude shirt, just to be on theme. And I was, like, ran upstairs. My sister was up there. And so I was like, help me find something. And she found a poncho that she gave me. So then I just was wearing a nude outfit and a poncho. And I walked into this dance. And I remember watching this 35-year-old man dressed as a duck do the electric slide. And it was like an all-time low. I was like, what? No. Why? And all that momentum that maybe I could meet somebody had drained with the vagina. And I remember just thinking about the feeling, right, that we probably all have, which is the square peg, round hole, square peg, round hole, square peg, round hole, again and again and again and again. And letting it go and thinking, like, I can't, I gotta go home. And I have a picture that I got a stranger to take of me on the subway that is one of my favorite photos, because in the photo I'm wearing the fortune cookie costume and I look like a giant vagina. It's very clear, but it's clear I don't know yet, so I'm just sort of smiling like, I'm a fortune cookie. And then really the contrast is truly, truly comedic. And I keep it on my desk to remind myself that you can't force fate. Thank you. All right, so I wrote this one for the conference, but I've never performed any of this before. And it's not that funny, okay? So don't prepare yourselves. It's a little more serious. Okay, so I think the main reason I stayed Mormon until I was 28 was because I loved God. And that was a relationship that was really cultivated from every moment you were scared when you were a kid and you prayed, to being told that you were a child of God and that God loved you. And I remember when I was 16, I went through a really hard patch of depression. I was new in school. I didn't have any friends. I weighed 265 pounds at the time. I was bullied, made fun of, and I was having, I would say, pretty close to, like, suicidal thoughts, because I felt like I was just totally worthless. And I was in my room crying one morning on a Saturday, and my dad came in, and he asked me what was wrong. And so I told him. I said that I feel like I'm worthless, and I wish I wasn't alive. And he said, you got your patriarchal blessing recently, right? And I had, and he made me go get it and take it out. And he read my patriarchal blessing to me. But he read it with, like, director's commentary. So every line he would stop and be like, see, Heavenly Father says that about you. Does that mean you're worthless? Listen to how Heavenly Father thinks. Heavenly Father wouldn't say that to somebody who wasn't special, who didn't have some reason to be alive. Heavenly Father loves you and believes in you. And he went through the whole blessing. And it really, it's a moment I think about, because it snapped me out of it. It was like I saw some light that somebody besides me believed in me. And I think when you think you're not worthy of love and something loves you, you become very grateful, because you know what you are. So the idea that somebody could love you is remarkable. And I later would, I would be in a car with my friend Debbie, who went to the same patriarch, and we, like, told each other blessings, and she had basically all the same lines as me. But still, I felt like the blessing was a thing to tell me I deserved to live. And And I developed a relationship with Heavenly Father, which maybe some of you also had, where he was like my best friend. Everywhere I went, I would be like, oh my gosh, did you see that? So funny, right? We talked all the time in my head. And I felt like I could face the world with this, like, partner. When I was 27, after years of doubt and questioning for multiple reasons that I'm sure all of you are personally familiar with, I decided that I wanted to stop being Mormon. And the hardest part about it for me was that you're taught that if you love me, you must keep my commandments. And so I loved God, and I knew in order to show him I loved him, the biggest thing I could do was keep his commandments. And suddenly, I was on a mission to break every single commandment, which, if you do the math, means I hate God, in my mind. And so I did something to help me psychologically deal with that. I took God out of my brain, and I sent him away. And I felt very lonely. And I don't know, do you guys remember the first Sunday you didn't go to church? Oh my gosh, it was like the longest 3 hours of my life. I just sat in my room like a caged animal, like, well, all my friends are over there. what am I, you know, and every Sunday for a while, it felt like that strange silence. And where I used to have like a method to deal with anxiety, fear, stress, anger, disgust, I would turn to Heavenly Father and I would pray. And suddenly, I had no one. And I didn't know what to do. But then I found out that there was a thing called alcohol. and you can drink and you forget about some of these things. The first time I smoked a cigarette properly, I remember feeling like a rush, like a high, and it felt the exact same way as when I felt the Holy Ghost, and I was like, oh, geez. I smoked American Spirits, too, so I was like, the spirit. I remember one night, like, as much as I tried to not let God walk with me anymore. I remember I had hooked up with this guy, was going to spend the night, and then had like a Mormon freak out, where I was like, no, I need to go home. So I left, and in the hours that I had been at his apartment, there had been a blizzard. So I walked out to the streets of New York, and they were covered in 10 inches of fresh snow, not a single footprint in them. It was probably 4 or 5 in the morning. And I remember walking home in the snow, and every footprint I made on the snow, I told myself, like, this is what you're doing. You see, the world is pure, and you're trampling on it. You're, you know, the narrative that we tell. And then I went home, and my heater had blown out because of the wind, and I couldn't get the pilot light to go back on, and it was freezing, and so I had to put on all my clothes and sleep on the couch, shivering. And I told myself that I had once lived in the light of God, and now I was in the shadows, shivering. And the funny thing is, I look back at that story now, and it's all about how you perceive it, right? Because I could have just said, like, I hooked up with a really hot dude. It was snowing. Snow's awesome. I went home, and I was cold, and I went to sleep. But instead, I told myself the story of being Jonah in the whale, that I was a sinner, that I had walked away from the truth, that I was fundamentally bad. And in the midst of that, I every now and then would have moments of clarity. 5 years in, after 5 years of not praying, I remember one night I was really stressed out, and I was staying near the ocean, so I went on a walk on the beach. And when I was Mormon, anytime I would see the moon, I would like think it was like, it would remind me of God. So I would see the moon, and I would always be like, hi, God, what's up? And I hadn't done that in 5 years. And I was walking late at night on the beach, and I looked up at the moon, and I sort of out of habit just said, hi, God. And all of a sudden, I just started crying. And I was like, oh my gosh, I've been such a bad friend. We haven't talked in so long. I miss you. And it just spilled out of me. And in a way that was like confusing. And then I left it, started walking back to where I was staying, which was about a mile down the beach. And just as I got home and turned, I looked up and the moon was in the same space right above my head in the sky, which is because that's how the moon works. But it occurred to me that whether you're walking towards God or away from God, it's just as close. And I think that there's this all or nothing feeling we have as Mormons, because Mormonism is supposed to be the fullness of the truth, which is that if you leave, you either are a religious person or you are nothing. You know, by, like, I'm not going to become Catholic. It's like I've seen Spotlight. It's a lateral move, guys. But then in this forced darkness, I feel like I forgot that I am a body, a mind, and a spirit. And in the last year, I have suddenly cracked that open again through therapy and a lot of effort, actually, I would say. I decided this last year to spend 20 hours a week focusing on my mental health, reading books, meditating, going to therapy, trying to figure out how to deal with this anxiety that I'd had that prayer used to answer. And in this time period, I read this book, and in the book, it's Howard Thurman, civil rights leader, interviewing Gandhi. And there was this quote, which I'll read to you, which says, they're making a case for the psychological benefit of faith or belief. And what Gandhi says is, a human needs a solid core of self-esteem before he can commit himself to personal, let alone social change. And that the awareness of being a child of God tends to stabilize the ego. And hearing that, it was like a new loophole. Where I was like, wait a second. So there's like a function it serves. And maybe I like that function. And all of a sudden, I thought, wait, do I believe in God? I think, and you know, if there are atheists here, fully admit I could be regressing. But the thought occurred to me that maybe I want to believe in God. And maybe it doesn't have to be the God I grew up with, but it can be those feelings. And once I thought that, it was like a wave of joy, like giddiness about this thing that I could let back in. And so I knelt down and I started to pray, and then I was like, kneeling feels weird. So then I just sat in Indian prayer, cross-legged. We don't say Indian anymore. cross-legged, and I held my hands out, and I said, I'd like to pray to you, God. And then I just basically said, this is who I am now. This is what I do. Poured my heart out and then said, can you accept me? And the thought occurred to me, can you accept yourself? And I think that that's a lot of it, that we only have one chance here to become. And for some of us, Mormonism helps us become. But for others, it's actually psychologically damaging. And the great thing about the world is there's so many ways to become if we try to find it. And that the church doesn't own what I love about God. Thank you. Got surprisingly emotional. Okay. Sorry, you guys could see that. That was a little pep talk for myself. All right, so this last piece is something I was asked to write a piece for an anthology of called Women of Letters. And so it's a book that is going to be made up of letters that women write to various topics. And so I was asked to write a letter to my biggest mistake. And so this is what I chose to write. All right. Dear self-hatred. Hi. I know we spoke a few minutes ago when you called me a fat, lazy idiot who shouldn't have drunk so much last night and then come home and ordered a quesadilla on Seamless, even though she's supposed to be juicing, or tried vaping for the first time last night because, hey, now is definitely the time to get into marijuana, and whose house is a disaster, and how am I 35 and this is what I amount to. Yeah, we talked the moment my eyes opened this morning. You were, as always, effective with your word choice, though calling me a dumb bitch was a bit harsh. But glutton for punishment that I am, I wanted to talk again as friends because, hey, we spend so much time together. Why not try it this way? You're already judging this letter, I can tell. I want to start by saying I can see where you're coming from. I was born into a body, and my body is female, and you correctly connected the dots. To succeed, I must be pretty, docile, submissive, kind, none of which came naturally to me, and pure. What a lie that is, pure. Fuck pure. The only pure people I know are pure because they've learned the art of repression and denial, like my mother, who taught me, when you have an angry or a sad thought, put it in a box in your head, take the box out of your head, put it on a shelf in the cupboard, and shut the cupboard. I'm still afraid to open cupboards when I go to my parents' house because I'm worried boxes with bits of my mother's brain will just come tumbling out. But no doubt this wisdom was passed on by her great-great-grandmother, one of 16 polygamous wives, who probably had angry or sad thoughts because she and 15 other women were baby-making machines for the same old white man. So yeah. A box would come in handy then. Get to the point, Elna. Thanks, self-hatred. Glad you're still reading this. You were carefully cultivated. Remember when we were 16 and we went on a church hike for 6 days called Trek, where we were forced to dress as pioneers, climb a mountain, and do a lot of trust falls? On the last day, the church leaders gave us a lesson on how the grace of Christ could take away our faults. You loved that shit. You'd been hoping for a solution for so long. They took us to a mountain ridge with a rock formation that looked like the back of a stegosaurus. They called it a dragon. One at a time, we were supposed to climb up the ridge and then stand on the back of the dragon. We weighed 265 pounds back then, and we were the least in shape, so it took us the longest to climb up. You hated that the rest of the kids were watching, waiting for us, dripping with sweat to make it up. Once we got up there, we were supposed to imagine our faults and then slay them like George slayed the dragon through the power of Christ, which, hey guys, pick one metaphor and stick to it. You chose to slay my fat body, my willfulness, my mean streak, and my evil thoughts. You pictured shoving the sword into my stomach like Harry Carey and pulling it out to see the new me reflected in the blade, a perfect girl, an Ivanka. We've tried ever since to keep our promise not to be all of the things that are bad about me. It's a daily grind, and you're a drill sergeant, always screaming in my ear about how I could do better. And frankly, I'm sick of it. Because what if the bad parts of me aren't my weakness? They just are. And what if we looked at everything that I am and just accepted it? I took the liberty of taking the first step. I wrote everything I've ever done wrong on a poster board. That's true, I did. In tiny font. And the list, it's riddled with idiocy, selfishness, fear, stupid choices. But actually, it's not even that bad. For all the times you tell me I'm a piece of shit, there isn't even that much material to work off of. And yet these screw-ups loom over me like redwoods. So, how do you get over it? Well, for whatever reason, I keep thinking about this thing that happened. Remember when we went to visit Grandma a few weeks after our big surgery? I had an open wound across my back that I was supposed to cover every day by taping a sheet of gauze over it. I'd been doing this for weeks, but I was too swollen and sore to remove the old tape every time I retaped it. So after a while, my back was covered in these tiny squares of tape that became black and grimy. It basically looked like target practice on my back.
And I tried one night to get just one of the pieces of tape off, and it took so much scrubbing and it left so much greasy, sticky feeling on my fingers that I gave up halfway through. And then I looked at my back in the mirror, and there were at least 30 or more of them, and I thought, oh, God, I'm going to have to die with these because I will never get this off. And I put fresh tape on the bandage, and I stuck it to my skin, knowing I was just adding more. And then we went to visit Grandma. And one night, I, still using a cane to get around, I asked if she'd help me into the shower. And she said yes, of course. And then as I was taking off my clothes, she saw my target practice back and gasped. And so she took me into the guest bedroom, and she had me lay down on the soft pink gingham duvet cover. And then she came back with a bowl of soapy water and a baby blue washcloth. And for an hour, she worked on my back, gently scrubbing off the tape marks one by one, patiently, until they were all gone. And I think about that now because it's the most compassionate thing anyone has ever done for me. And I wish that she were still alive or that I could summon her ghost to go back through all these mistakes I've made and scrub them gently like she did that tape so they'd lose their hold on me. But the problem is I don't think that's how ghosts work. And also, my grandmother wasn't there when I learned how and why I should hate myself. So I am the only one who can undo it. And I've known this for a while. But how do I start? How do you break away from this correct way of being a woman I think I'm failing at every day? Do you want to know a family secret? It's about Grandma, the woman who was our role model for goodness and kindness and the most amazing grandmother. I didn't know this until after she died, but when Grandma first began menopause, it made her grouchy, angry, and she lashed out at Grandpa, who was basically Archie Bunker, sitting on his reclining couch throne, expecting her to wait on him. Well, my grandma got mad for the first time, and it startled everyone. It wasn't a Mormon way for a woman to behave. And so she blamed it on menopause, and so the doctor gave her these hormonal pills that delayed the effects of menopause. And she took them for the next 20 years, basically the entire time I knew her. And then she died relatively young, in her 70s, from breast cancer, which she got as a direct result of taking the nice hormone pills. And I wish I could have had just one more week with my grandmother. I miss her every single day. And I wish someone had told her, it's okay to be mad, to say, I'm over this shit. I'm not making another goddamn sandwich for you, Carl. But they didn't. And I'm doing the same thing in my own way. I used to take diet pills to stay thin. I take sleeping pills to shut off my brain to go to sleep. It's all part of the same thing. I'm trying to avoid the parts of me I do not like at any cost. But there are no shortcuts. And if I choose this way, I will have to pay for it one way or another. But will it take 10 or 20 years of my life, or 5 or 2? How many years is it worth the not feeling? If I only get one chance to be a human, and if this is it, I don't want to spend it trying to erase myself. So hi, this is all to say, this is why I am writing. Because I don't think that what you were told is true anymore. I think you were told to hate yourself so that you would be subservient to someone else, or obey Mormonism, or become a wife, a servant, or be part of a larger society that hates women and female power. So instead of slaying the dragon, denying, hating, trying to annihilate the fierce part of me, why don't we work together? Why don't we just see what's here? Accept it. Rather than slay the dragon, let's breathe our fire. Thank you. Thank you, guys. You've been a lovely audience.
Okay, we have time for about 3 or 4 questions. So we don't have our audience mic. So what I need you to do is you're going to raise your hand, and then I'm going to repeat it for the recording. I mean now. Oh, sorry. Yes, go ahead. So the question is about how Elna's parents have responded to her life now.
I have amazing parents, and I think, if anything, the most anxiety I've felt over and over again is that I am just one choice away from losing them, because of, in a sense, it's because I love them so much. And I've been lucky to discover, and there have been definitely rough patches, that as I continue to push the boundaries of what I ever expected them to be okay with and accept, they continually respond with love and acceptance. But it does take time for them to not be afraid of my life, not be afraid of my choices. So as of right now, we're in a good place. But I am about to write a bunch of new stuff. And I swear every night I'm like, it actually is artistically very, I'm always afraid. Yeah. Any other questions? Yes.
So you got married.
Yes. My husband is named, she would like to know, she said, I got married. She'd like to know about my husband and what he's like. Kate has met my husband. Yeah. He's like a ball of enthusiasm. I basically married the human version of a puppy. He's just really excited. He has been really supportive of the fact that I'm Mormon, partly because he spends so much time. In fact, my family goes to church at 9 a.m., so when I visit, I sleep in, but my husband goes to church with him. And so he actually has his own fake version of giving his testimony that he likes to do as a bit. He also knows how to do a fake prayer. It's interesting. I think sometimes when we're misunderstanding one another, I'll often say, well, you'll never understand me because you're not Mormon. I don't know if other people feel that way. And I try to give him the cliff notes, but the good thing is that there's all of you who understand me, and I don't need a husband to do that necessarily. Cool. Any other questions? Yes, right there.
So you get paid to tell stories.
I do, yeah.
That's what you do all the time.
Yeah.
And so you go, like, on radio shows, or what else do you do? Tell us what your life is like.
Okay. This is like,
everything.
Wow. This is like, she would like to know, she says, I get paid to tell stories, and she's curious to know what my life is like. For the last 6 years, I've made my living only from telling stories. Prior to that, I was like a nanny and a hostess at a restaurant. So the last 6 years have been really lovely in that I work for This American Life, and I find stories for them. So half of the week, I'm looking for stories, interviewing people. I'm always on the lookout for good stories. And then the other half of the week, I'm writing stories. I maybe do 2 shows a week where I perform. And I also, this last year, sold a TV show based on the stories that I tell. So I've been writing that show for IFC. And hopefully, if all goes well, then it'll become an actual show that you see, but it might not. So, yeah. I feel really lucky that what I love most is what I get to do. Granted, I don't think I've ever had more than $5,000 in my bank account, so it's not a glamorous life, but it's creative. Yes. Oh, Ira is the greatest. Ira is really, I think he's one of the smartest people I know. He operates like rapid fire. He's funny. He does magic tricks, and he makes balloon animals. He has been I'm lucky to say that he's been a good friend for the last 8 or 9 years. Yeah. Yes. How do I feel about organized religion? you know, I feel like I have been through almost the stages of grief about it. I think if you talked to me a year and a half ago, especially in regards to Mormonism, I was going through the anger stage, reading a lot of the things I didn't know about the organization of the church, Joseph Smith, and I felt like I had been manipulated and that my pure, sweet, young, innocent self had been, manipulated. But I also feel like in the time that I've spent really trying to work through this, it started to feel a little bit like don't throw the baby out with the bathwater. And I can see the benefits that the community I grew up in have given me for my own stability, sense of morality. And right now I'm not part of an organized religion. I am that thing that when I was Mormon, I thought you couldn't be, which was like somebody who's spiritual. I guess I always thought like, you're cheating. Like somebody who does that is cheating. That's not allowed. But I do feel, I don't feel like I'm missing something from my life in the way I expected when I left the church. Any other questions? Yes. Yeah, I think, she would like to know how you, when you're writing about people that you know and love and depicting them, how do you deal with that tension of the way that you've depicted them, even though it's your story that you're trying to tell? And that is something that, again, part of the tension with how I feel about my family is based around that. I also have become more aware of the perspective. Like, the story that you tell isn't the right story necessarily, and you color people in a certain light. You know, my whole life I feel like I've been very hard on my mother, and I'm only starting to see that. And so in writing about people, my dream is that they'll never read it, I guess. But when I wrote my book, I did have the people who were depicted in it. I asked for their approval first. But I do, yeah, it's always a challenge because you try to be fair, but then again, no one likes to be seen without the control of showing, like, this is who I am, this is how I want you to see me. They lose that control the second you're describing them. Okay, one more question in the back. Oh, good question. My book, I write about hooking, or this movie star that tried to hook up with me when I was still Mormon. And it was Sam Shepard, who's a playwright and was in Baby Boom. So that's who it was, which many of you don't know, but yeah, Google him. Is that it? Yeah, that's it. Thank you guys so much. You've been lovely.
One more big, enthusiastic round of applause for our girl, Eleanor Baker. Okay, and now to the second half of our evening, which I'm really excited about, is another light in our community, Mindy Gledhill, who is one of the most gracious human beings I've ever met and just generous and beautiful inside and out. Mindy Gledhill's musical journey has led her all over the map, from recording a wildly successful independent album in Los Angeles with Juno nominated producer Stuart Brawley from Lenka and Emmy Rossum, to creating her latest solo record in the creative epicenter of East Nashville with acclaimed producer Carson Cooley from Sixpence None the Richer, Katie Herzig, Matthew Perryman Jones.
Sparks really flew when she was featured on the Grammy-nominated album Cascades, Fire and Ice, and when her song debuted on the primetime TV So You Think You Can Dance, Bones 2020 and The Good Wife. Who heard that? Like, I was like, yes, 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 that's Mindy. It's really exciting. And in commercials for LG Phones, Fruit of the Looms, Olympic ad campaign 2012, and State Farmers Insurance Super Bowl campaign 2014. So a little Mormon girl playing in the Super Bowl commercials is a big deal. Her most recent creative endeavor has been the release of an electronic project called Hive Riot, which was launched as a platform to raise awareness and fund for the LGBTQIA rights. Coincidentally, Hive Riot won Best Pop Album at the Independent Music Awards in 2016. And if you haven't listened to Hive Riot, it's what I listen to like all day, every day. I'm really excited for that. So with a big round of applause, let's give a big hand to Mindy Gledhill.
Thank you, Lindsay. Wow, it's been kind of interesting for me to observe those in attendance here, and I have been a little bit nervous. I'm just going to admit that to you because I haven't performed for a Mormon audience for a very long time, and I know that this is people from all different backgrounds, and that means a lot of different things for a lot of people, but for whatever reason, it's kind of triggering some things for me, and I don't want to tell you about those things and just be vulnerable and open, and I'm glad this is a place where people can do that. So maybe I'll start by just telling you that in 2013, I started to write an album. It's called Pocketful of Poetry. And it's a collection of songs that kind of arcs through a bit of a roller coaster of things I was feeling at that time in my life. And I was starting to ask some really deep questions about my faith. I'd never heard of a Lindsay Hansen Park. I'd never heard of a John DeLynn or a Mormon Stories. I'd never heard of Sunstone Symposium. I'd never heard of anything like that. I was just kind of on my own, just grappling with really difficult questions. And I think I was really closeted about that for a long time, particularly because many of you might know or recognize me as having been a poster child for LDS music. You may have heard me on EFY albums. You may have heard me I meet a lot of people who served missions who would say, oh, your music was the soundtrack to my mission. And all of those things are so meaningful to me when people tell me that. But as I was embarking on a different journey with my faith, it was very terrifying to feel all of those things. And so I felt like I was going on this spiritual journey, and I took my life on this literal journey to try to start piecing together my life and finding answers to my questions. And one thing that I felt really strongly about doing was going back to my roots and going back to the place where I grew up as a child. And Mormonism was so central to my childhood. I grew up in a big LDS family of 9 kids in Northern California. I was always pretty much one of the only Mormon kids around in school. But it was it's just such a big part of my memories as a child. So I went back to my childhood home to try to piece together, see if I could find any treasures of information there and find any inspiration for writing and try to see how I could recreate home and what that meant to me anymore and how I was going to create that for my children. So this is called Finding Home.
Remember when the grass was tall? And we built castles out of gold and straw. Our feet were bare, our tangled hair blew in the humid ocean air. The old blue house reflected on sky within the silver pond, and horses grazed inside a maze of thistle thorns and barley blades. And I'm following a trail that I've seen in fairy tales, but the crumbs I left behind are gone. So I'm trusting in my feet, and I'm skipping to a beat of a heart that's sweet on finding home. La 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 la. We rode our bikes out in the rain. We felt the jingle of our pocket change. Off to explore the bins galore of penny candies at the corner store. And I'm following a trail that I've seen in fairy tales, but the crumbs I left behind are gone. So I'm trusting my feet, and I'm skipping to a beat of a heart that's sweet on finding home. La 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 la. 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 And I'm following a trail that I've seen in fairy tales, but the crumbs I left behind are gone. So I'm trusting in my feet, and I'm skipping to a beat of a heart that's sweet on finding home.
La 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 la. La 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 la. La 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 la. La 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 la.
Thank you.
And sometimes you have to leave your home and lose your home to find it. Sounds like something we hear a lot. Sometimes you have to lose yourself to find yourself again. So that's what this next song's about.
Well, you won't believe what I'm gonna be when it's time for me to run. I'm gonna leave this nest and give my best to the place where I grew up. And there won't be trouble in the world no more. There won't be trouble in the world no more. There won't be trouble in the world no more. There won't be trouble in the world no more. I've got a wishing bone and a worry stone. And if I ever get bored of the open road, well, I'll bring my comic book. And there won't be trouble in the world no more. There won't be trouble in the world no more. There won't be trouble in the world no more. There won't be trouble in the world no more. No more band-aids on my heartaches. No more smoke when there's always better luck tomorrow. Well, I travel far to the great bazaar and charm a snake or two, or try my hand in a marching band while I play on my kazoo. And there won't be trouble in the world no more. There won't be trouble in the world no more. There won't be trouble in the world no more. There won't be trouble in the world no more. No more band-aids on my heartaches. No more. more smoke when I burn the pancakes. No more drowning in my sorrow. When the gin hit up, there's always better luck. Like a beggar in the street with a penny in his cup. The penny gets thrown in the wishing well. It goes to show you never can tell when a penny might bring a million better things tomorrow. No more band-aids on my heartaches. No more smoke when I burn the pancakes. No more drowning in my sorrow. When my chin hill up, there's always better luck tomorrow. No more band-aids on my heartaches. No more smoke when I burn the always better luck tomorrow.
Thank you. It's been mentioned. I know Elna talked about it. I know that there was even a session about it maybe yesterday or today, but just about relationships with families and how those are affected when maybe children decide to leave or a parent leaves, or there's all different kinds of situations there, I know. And it has been something that's been difficult for my parents and my family. So this song is really a song that I wrote for my dad. It's called Little Red Bike, and I used to have a little red Schwinn as a kid, and it was the bike that I learned how to ride a bike on. And the song's really just about just my kind of message to my dad about how it's okay to let me go. It's okay to let me differentiate, I know is a word that we hear a lot. So this is a Little Red Bike.
The air feels feather light against my apple trees in the driveway. I try to balance right and push the pedals as I ride. You by my side, holding on for dear life, with the sun in my eyes. After cars, while time is chasing after me. sun in my eyes. And with the love you love, you let go of my little red bike.
Thank you. I want to introduce Joe Corcoran up here tonight. Please give him a hand. Joe has been a really dear friend for a long time. He's played on most of my albums and written a lot of my songs with me. He and has done so many events with me that have probably felt pretty foreign to him. He's not Mormon, doesn't have a Mormon background at all. So I just, Joe, thank you for doing these things with me. We've already honorarily, like, knighted him a citizen of Provo because he's come to play so many times for me down there. So I already talked for a second about my Pocket Full of Poetry album. There's a part of me that I feel like people know me a lot for happy, upbeat songs. I think what they don't know is that a lot of the time those are my attempts at creating happiness, where it's lacking in my life, or where things are difficult in my life, and I have moments that are just dark, and just, I think, like most of humanity, where I'm grappling, I'm trying to figure life out. Pocket Full of Poetry is one of those songs for me. It's also kind of an anthem for me when I was coming to like a place where I could start to admit to myself that I have a voice that's independent, and I have my own story, and that's enough. I don't need anything else other than that. I don't do well if I'm kept behind an office desk inside. It makes me lose my mind, which wanders endlessly, where all the birds fly freely with their silhouettes in perfect symmetry. I've got a pocket full of poetry. I've got a head full of songs, a heart with wings. You couldn't tie me down to anything. That's enough for me. Draw doodles of eccentric faces in margin spaces of important papers. Then I hand them in with a comedic grin. You ask if I need help, or where do I begin? I've got a pocket full of poetry. I've got a head full of songs, a heart with wings. You couldn't tie me down to anything, and that's enough for me. Good lovingly they tell me, do as you should or will be well. They say life is a test, please give the best answer, A or B or C, pick one instantly. What if there's so much more to me? I've got a pocket full of poetry. I've got a head full of songs, a heart with wings. You couldn't tie me down to anything, and that's enough for me. I've got a pocket full of poetry. I've got a head full of songs, a heart with wings. You couldn't tie me down to anything, and that's enough for me. I've got a pocket full of poetry. I've got a head full of songs, a heart with wings. You couldn't tie me down to anything, and that's enough for me. Thank you. Joe, I have a confession.
Okay.
There's a song I forgot to put on the set list, on your set list. Oh, no, it's there. It's there. All About Your Heart.
Yeah.
Okay. From here, it's in the shadows.
Crisis averted.
Crisis averted. Okay. So I think in all of this roller coastering and journeying, for me, there have been points, really, you know, some really low points where I have felt wounded and scarred, and often by my own people, people that I love and have trusted my whole life, and then suddenly, you know, in my journey to figure out truth and to figure out what is right for me, you know, I think we've all experienced that can scare people. And so this song is really just about how we all have scars, some visible, some invisible, and how that's just not really who we are or what we're about.
I don't mind your odd behavior. It's the very thing I love. If you were an ice cream flavor, you would be my favorite one. My imagination sees you like a painting by Van Gogh. Starry nights and bright sunflowers follow you where you may go. Oh, I've loved you from the start in every single way, and more each passing day.
is spinning round like a red balloon, way up in the clouds, and my feet will not stay on the ground. You anchor me back.
Thank you. Okay, we have one more song for you tonight. This song is in the church film Meet the Mormons, and it's interesting. I'll tell you a little backstory that not a lot of people know, but I had already made my way out of the church at the point when they called me and asked me if they could use this song in the film. And I wrestled with it just because I was wrestling with everything and just my feelings and relationship with the church and just didn't know what it all meant and how I could still keep a good relation with the church and with the people I worked with there, but at the same time not wanting to know if I wanted to be attached to the film. So there was a lot of inner turmoil, but I decided I would at least go and show up to the meeting where they were kind of presenting. They were showing like a pre-screening of the film to people that they wanted to have do the music for the film. So I got there, and it was really interesting because every single woman in the room were contemporaries of mine, but they had all left as well. So when you listen to the film, most of the music in it is made by people who have left. Even the main theme song of the whole film. In fact, my friend who wrote the main theme song she jokes that she was drinking a glass of wine when they called her to ask if they could use the song, and it's just kind of just one of those silly things. But anyway, I watched the scene that they wanted to put this song to. And I decided to collaborate with them and let them use a song. The scene is of a woman. She's from Brazil. She's a kickboxing champion. and it's of her training. And so I just thought, this is really new territory to highlight. She's also a mother. Highlight a mother who is a world-class athlete, and highlight her story. And so I thought that it would be a really great thing to do. And that's a relationship that I continue to really explore and appreciate. I appreciate that I will still get a call from BYU to come. I spoke to their music program a couple of weeks ago, and keeping those relationships are important to me because why not? At least for me personally. And I recognize that there are some relationships that are just not safe or not worth keeping for everyone, and I honor that as well. But it's been, I've had some really good experiences and hope to continue to be able to keep Mormon friends and family a part of my life. Anyway, so we'll end with Whole Wide World.
I'm gonna walk 100 miles. I'm gonna whistle all the while. If that's what it takes to make me smile, I'm gonna walk 100 miles. And I'm gonna run right up this hill. Summer sky or winter chill. If I gotta take a break, I will. But I'm gonna run right up this hill. I wanna hold the whole wide world right here in my open hands. And maybe I'm just a little girl with great big plans. I'm gonna go and take a chance. I'm gonna learn to ballet dance. Learn a little something about romance. I'm gonna go and take a chance. I'm gonna live a crazy dream, impossible as it may seem. Doesn't matter what the future brings, I'm gonna live a crazy dream. And I wanna hold the whole wide world right here in my open hands. And maybe I'm just a little girl with great big plans. I wanna hold the whole wide world right here in my open hands. And maybe I'm just a little girl with great big plans. You tell me, don't try it. Well, I'm warning you.
Thank you so much. Joe. Thank you. Thank you. That was a lovely surprise. Thank you. Okay. I'd love to leave you with a song called Honey. I think if you've ever been through what it's like to go through a transition out of your faith, then you know how difficult that really is. And sometimes it gets mischaracterized as just wanting to take the easy way out or just wanting to be careless with your life and go make a bunch of bad choices. And sometimes that's really what we do when we are raised in a certain faith and we leave and it's all we know. And sometimes, you know, we don't make the best choices because we're learning to use our critical thinking for the first time. But a lot of the time, most people just want to do the right thing, whatever the right thing means for them. But those moments can get really dark and scary, and you can just feel lost and ugly. And anyway, that's what this song's about.
When you're blue, buried deep, 60,000 leagues under the bottom of the sea, well, I will swim to set you free. I will swim to set you free. Honey, when you feel worn out, when the mirror lies and turns on you, when the choruses of doubt are singing way too loud, honey, I will chase them down. Honey, that's what love's about. Well, you weren't once revolved 1,000 miles per hour. It as it falls and fizzles at a slow dissolve. It fizzles at a slow dissolve. Honey, when you feel worn out, when the mirror lies and turns on, when the choruses of doubt are singing way too loud, honey, I will chase them down. Honey, that's what love's about. I hope you know you are more beautiful than you dream you. And maybe all things must pass, but now you're still waiting through the ash while the fire lasts. Honey, when you feel worn out, when the mirror lies and turns on you, when the choruses of doubt are singing way too loud, honey, I will chase them down. Honey, that's what love's about.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you so much.
Can we
I should say I'd love to, I'm going to stay after and chat with anyone that wants to chat for a little while, and you can also find me on social media. I'm super active on Instagram. That's my favorite. And you can find all these songs on iTunes and on Spotify. Thanks.
Can we bring Alna up here too, and Mindy? Mindy is truly a light on a hill, and I think we need to give her a really loud round of applause for how beautiful. I just want to bring her and Alna up really quick. We just have something. We're going to let you go, but let's get these two together. One last round of applause. Just, again, our appreciation for what they've given back to their Mormon community. They are women who sort of left the tribe to find themselves and bring the gifts back to us, and we are so grateful. And again, I just wanted to thank you on behalf of Sunstone for showing up, for practicing empathy, for being wonderful, and for claiming each other and being here to love and support one another this year. And as we go again for one more year, our different ways, I'm so excited to see what you bring back to the Mormon table next year. So again, thank you so much for coming.